This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Lauren Bacall, the actress whose deep voice and sultry on-screen presence made her an instant star in the 40s, died Tuesday in New York. She was 89. Though she made more than 40 films and won Tony Awards in the 70s and 80s, she was forever associated with Humphrey Bogart, her husband and co-star early in her career. Here they are in her most iconic scene from her very first movie, the 1944 wartime romance To Have and Have Not.
You know, Steve, you're not very hard to figure. Only at times. Sometimes I know exactly what you're going to say. Most of the time. The other times... The other times you're just a stinker.
What'd you do that for?
Been wondering whether I'd like it.
What's the decision?
I don't know yet. It's even better when you help. Sure you won't change your mind about this?
Uh-huh.
This belongs to me and so do my lips. I don't see any difference.
Oh, I do.
Okay. You know you don't have to act with me, Steve. You don't have to say anything and you don't have to do anything. Not a thing. Oh, maybe just whistle. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
Bacall began an affair with Bogart then, when he was more than twice her age. They married a few months later. She was 19 when they met and 32 when he died of cancer in 1957. Before Bogey's death, they made several more films together, including The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, and Key Largo, and they joined other actors in forming a committee to resist the anti-communist investigations of the House Un-American Activities Committee. After Bogart's death, Bacall had a brief engagement to Frank Sinatra and an 8-year marriage to Jason Robards. Her other films include Young Man with the Horn, How to Marry a Millionaire, Blood Alley, Written on the Wind, Designing Woman, Murder on the Orient Express, The Shootist, and Misery. She won Tony Awards for her performances in Applause and Woman of the Year. And in 2009, she received an Honorary Academy Award. Terry spoke to Lauren Bacall in 1994.
Your voice is one of the kind of special voices from film, and you have a deep voice. I'm wondering if you were ever self-conscious about your voice before realizing what an asset it was. Was your voice deep when you were a teenager?
Yes, it always has been deep. I've always had a low voice. My mother had one, and my daughter has one.
Did you like it when before you were
I don't think I ever thought about it, you see. In actual fact, I have never been one, even from childhood, to kind of analyze myself very much. My voice has been somewhat of a drawback now because there are people, first of all, we won't discuss, so I pick up the phone, they say, yes, sir, you know. I say, yes, and I am not a sir, and they keep saying, yes, sir, we know, sir. Nobody listens. And also, I think it's one of the reasons that the perception of me has been that I'm so in control and so strong, so tough, because I have this deep voice. But I don't want to change it, and I can't change it.
On the first film that you made, To Have and Have Not, your voice was really quite outstanding. You used it to great effect. Now, when Howard Hawks, the director of that film, first noticed you, he probably had no idea what your voice was like because he first saw you on the cover of Harper's Bazaar. He was attracted by your look and had no idea what your voice was like.
Right. That's true. Howard was a fascinating man because I didn't know how to drive a car, and he used to pick me up and take me to a studio or wherever he was taking me, and we would have lunch and so forth, and he would tell me about scenes with different actresses when he was directing Carol Lombard in 20th Century or when he was directing Jean Arthur in Only Angels Have Wings or Rita Hayworth or whoever he was directing, whatever woman he was directing, he would always tell me these stories. And his fantasy was always to find an unknown girl and make her a star. His Svengali instincts were very ripe. The only thing that he wanted me to do, keep my voice at a low register in the middle of an emotional scene of any kind, because normally in an emotional scene, when you're emotional, your voice tends to rise. And he didn't want mine to rise. And so he had this vision. And he told me about it. He wanted me to keep my voice down for all of those scenes that required either anger or excitement or any scene that would normally provoke a rise in your voice. He wanted it to be kept down. So he liked it. And it could not be low enough to suit him. Something in his head, you see. I mean, he had this dream.
Well, you say he really wanted to make you into his version of the ideal woman. What was that ideal?
Well, that ideal was a woman who was could give as good as she got, who had humor, who was kind of a woman of the world and somewhat insolent, and actually who behaved rather like a man.
What did that mean, to behave rather like a man?
Well, that you would look, you know, if a man said something to you, you would look at him directly. And he didn't like shy wallflower types. And always with humor, though, and always somewhat suggestive that something was in the offing. Something could happen. And you weren't quite sure what that something was. But you knew that it would be fun and fascinating. And probably different, unusual. I mean, he had this incredible thing going on in his brain, and it worked, because I was insolent, and he wanted someone. He always said he wanted someone as insolent as Bogart.
Did you find that kind of woman appealing?
Appealing?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, kind of fascinating, adventurous, and I mean, when you are playing a part like that, where you have traveled, I mean, you begin to think, God, what a great life. Independent and living alone, and how dramatic. You know, I was so stage-struck and star-struck and everything-struck that I loved the idea of adventure and the idea, the drama of everything was so appealing to me. I mean, that was the fun of acting to me, that I could lose myself in all of that stuff.
You had something that was described as the look. I mean, your eyes were kind of droopy, and you'd look at people with your head lowered a little bit. And
yes, and I'd look up at them.
Yeah. So describe the look a little bit more.
Chin on chest.
And how you got it.
Well, I was terribly nervous during To Have and Have Not. It was quite a terrifying experience for me. And I was this kid, and I was scared to death of all these pros around me, and really had almost no experience on the stage. And certainly none in film. So I was shook when Hawk said action and there was quiet on the set. I'd start to walk into a scene and then my head would shake and my hands would shake. And I discovered that if I kept my head down and looked up, my head would not shake. So I started to do that when I could, when it was appropriate in a scene. And that's how the look came about. But it wasn't that I had planned to have a look. It was just that it was a way to keep my head steady, and that was very important. Terrible to look at another actor while your head is shaking.
Before you ever really experienced love, you were acting out the movie version of romance, and then you started having the romance with the person who you were acting it out with on screen.
The early romance was the most romantic experience I have ever had in my life, far surpassing anything that I might have dreamed of or imagined. It was quite amazing. I mean, when you are young and when it's your first love and you are just carried away by it and when that's all you can think about. And you see, Bogey was the kind of man who believed in taking care of a marriage and taking care of a relationship. He believed you had to work at it and keep it fresh and fun and interesting, and he did.
He was already a movie star to you, right?
Oh, yes,
when you worked
absolutely.
Together. So you had a sense of him as an icon as well as
no,
a man.
No, not as an icon. He was not my favorite movie star.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell him that?
Yes, he knew it. No, Leslie Howard was my favorite. Uh-huh. He knew that. But he had worked with Leslie Howard in Petrified Forest, which is funny, you know. No, he wasn't an icon when I met him. I mean, he was after Casablanca, and he was a big star, but certainly not what he is today, which is this legend, this incredible icon now. I mean, he is bigger than ever.
I'm sure you've been asked this a zillion times, but do you think that what you and Bogart were feeling off screen, you can see on screen? I mean, that the real relationship registers in the movie?
Well, I think sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. Certainly the chemistry registers, whether it is a consummated relationship or not. I think if there is chemistry between two people, you feel it. I think that Bogey and myself in To Have and Have Not, having fallen in love with one another. First of all, it was great for me because he wanted me to be good in it, so he made it much easier for me to play the scenes. And of course, my feeling, you know, the feeling was so strong that, you know, originally in To Have and Have Not, his character was supposed to have a little flirtation with the other woman. And once Hawks saw the rushes of the scenes that Bogey and I had played, Bogey said to him, nobody is ever going to accept or believe that he would go off with anybody else for a second. And it was true.
When you and Bogart decided to get married, you write that he said to you that he wanted to marry you, but only if you were willing to give up going on location for a film because he didn't want you both going off in different directions.
Right.
How do you feel about that in retrospect?
Well, I recognize the fact completely that separation does not breed a happy marriage. I think you must be together. I mean, the reason you get married is to be together, not to be separated. And I think particularly in my profession, but in any profession, I think if you each go off in opposite directions, sooner or later, one of you is going to go off and not come back. I agreed to his terms.
But you wanted so much to be an actress.
Right.
And this cut down on the roles that you could take.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And I never even got the offers because I was thought of as Bogey's wife, and then I would just go with him on location, which I did. And we were never separated. We were separated once only for a very short time.
Well, you know, I was thinking how in a way frustrating it must have been when he was making African Queen with Katharine Hepburn. You were there in Africa with them, kind of suffering through through all of the problems they had to suffer through. But I mean, you were there as the wife. And
I was there as the wife. I was
not
in charge
as the star.
Of lunch. No, right.
So
no,
how
but
did
you
that
know,
feel?
I had a lot of frustrations mm-hmm. about my career.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, times where I felt I should have been considered for a part that I wasn't considered for. Bogey had decided early on and told me from the very beginning that he would never interfere with my career, that whatever I did professionally, I would do only with myself and my agent. If I wanted his advice, I could ask him, but that he would never step in, and he never did. And sometimes I thought, well, he ought to step in. I mean, once in a while, I should be in a movie with him that one of the parts is... But whatever his decision was, he was correct because he'd had enough experience to know what worked and what didn't work. And I was very frustrated at times, but I still believe, and I even believed then, that even throughout my frustration, that the choice I made was the right one. Obviously, in view of what happened, it most certainly was the right one. And I'm really happy that I made that choice.
Because your life together
was
short.
Well, because he had a life. He had a life that he never thought he would have. And it was very short. But imagine if I'd gone off somewhere. Well, I mean, he wouldn't have stood for it anyway, so.
After his death, how did that change for you the life you wanted for yourself professionally?
Well, unfortunately, it didn't change very much because, you know, when people get in the habit of not seeing you very much on screen, that habit kind of carries over. And I played in a movie that was very mediocre.
Which movie?
What was it called? I forgot. With Robert Stack, about the little girl with the horse and the gift of love. Wasn't very good. It was a remake, and it wasn't a good remake. And then I went to Europe to be in a movie in England, and India, which of course I loved. And that movie was quite a good movie, but But my career never, you see, then I had to leave California. There was no life for me there. And so my career then shifted to the stage. Then, of course, they don't think about you at all in movies.
Right, because you're outside.
Oh, no. Oh, she wants to be in the theater. Oh, who cares? We're on to the next.
So what did you do to make it clear that you wanted back in?
Well, I just think if you just keep, hang in there, you know, and just keep working in one medium or another, I have still not gotten my choice of the best roles in the world. There are still friends that don't think of me for parts because we're friends. Well, I mean, that's life. And that's the biz.
I want to ask you about working with some of the many people you've worked with,
yes,
over the
absolutely.
Years and see if you could share some of your impressions of them. Faulkner wrote the script, or co-wrote the script, for your first two movies. Did you work with him directly?
Well, not really, but I saw him a lot because he was in Hawks' office all the time. And I remember in The Big Sleep one day he came on the set with a scene that he had written. And Hawks, of course, brought it over and showed it to Bogey and me. And what he had done was he had written a speech that was 2 pages long for one character. Now, that's the way he wrote. But you couldn't, on a movie screen, have one person talking for that length of time. Hawks just thought it was great. He thought it was kind of funny. But I got to know Faulkner when we were in Italy. He was there, and we would see him. He was a shy, brilliant, and really charming, charming man. And if you ever get a chance to find to read his Nobel Prize speech, it was a most amazing talk. He had quite a mind, quite an exceptional mind, and he was an adorable little man because, you know, he had a big drinking problem. He would say, we saw him in Rome, and we said, what are you going to do now, Bill? He said, well, I thought that I would drive down to the south, tasting the wine of the country as I go.
You work with Marilyn Monroe on mm-hmm. How to Marry a Millionaire. How was the experience of working with her?
It was fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got along very well. My only complaint about her was that she was late all the time. But she was late out of fear as much as anything else. But it was hard to sit around and wait, you know. But she was usually an hour or two late every morning.
You strike me as such different types, probably off the screen, certainly on the screen.
Oh, yes, we are. I mean, I wish I had been as photogenic as she was. But she was a very kind of sweet, kind of far away, very self-involved, but not, I mean, she had no meanness. She was not bitchy. She was not strident in any way. She was just always seemed a little lost to me, wistful kind of, but just kind of not quite there. Do you know what I mean? And you'd be playing a scene with her, and she would go over and over the scene, and you'd have to be on your toes because she'd do many, many takes. And she always had the coach on the set, which was a big annoyance, you know, that's constantly, instead of looking at you, she'd be looking at the coach. That kind of thing was difficult. But personally, she really was sweet. I mean, we did get along well.
Kirk Douglas. Now, he was your boyfriend before you even...
Oh, I had such a crush on him. Oh, he was so dazzling when I was 15 and he was 115. No. And he was... God, he was attractive. And I just took one look at him and I was sunk.
This is when you were in high school or right after high school?
I was at the American Academy. I was 15 years old. I was just enamored of him. And he was pretty dashing and dazzling, wonderful, wonderful actor. And, of course, I was involved in his beginning. When Bogey and I were going on the train to New York once, Hal Wallace was on the train with us, and Kirk was in a play in New York with a small part. And I told Hal about him. I said, you better go see this guy. He's a wonderful actor. And Hal did, and then signed him. And that's how his career started in pictures.
No, after being a boyfriend and girlfriend when you were very young, what was it like to be in a movie with him in Young Man with a Horn?
Well, it was great. It was fun because, first of all, we each of us had other lives mm-hmm. by then.
Right.
And we were very secure in all our own lives. But, of course, when you remember those times, it's kind of fun. You know, you have that kind of little flirtation going on that doesn't really mean anything, but it just all has to do with the past.
John Wayne, you worked with him in two movies, Blood Alley in the 50s, and then The Shootist in, was it 75, 76?
77.
77, okay. And The Shootist was his last movie, and he had cancer in real life and also in the movie.
That,
the character
was
you know, an aged gunfighter who was dying of cancer. I'm wondering what it was like then, knowing that he was really sick, that would probably be his last movie, not wanting to kind of over-dramatize the significance of that, but here he is playing out the drama on screen that's happening off screen, and you know what's happening, but you don't want to get too...
Well, you couldn't with him.
Mm-hmm.
I learned through Bogey's illness that the person who is ill is the one who dictates your behavior.
Right, right. You take your cues from them.
Right. And Bogey never discussed it and never talked about it once after his surgery. And so I never did.
Mm-hmm.
And
You never talked about it together?
No. No. And, you know, we say some days, you know, I don't feel so good today, or I have to do this, you know, I have to go have this radiation or what, you know, stuff like that. But, I mean, he never talked to me about if something happens or what might, you know, never. Now, Duke was the same. Duke never talked about it. I mean, mind you, I wasn't married to him, but he still, we knew each other fairly well and never talked about it, and he handled himself impeccably. Well, you have to go along with that. You know, he was, he was very strange contradiction of a man to me because he, of course, politically we didn't agree about anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were really on opposite sides. And vehemently so we never discussed it, obviously. But we worked very well together. And he was sweet with me, and he was really attractive, you know. He had a quality that surprised me, that he did have a kind of a real appeal. I mean, there was a reason he was such a big star. He was a real man, and he had real appeal. And so, I mean, although I'm sure he realized it would be his last picture, and I certainly did, it was never discussed. It was just, we just went from day to day, and he'd say, oh, I can't drink anymore, I can't smoke anymore. He said, all the fun's gone. You know, we'd say something like that, but other than that, no.
Frank Sinatra, no. Well, here's my question. It's not a very personal one, but you almost got married, or I mean, a gossip columnist said that you were engaged. You had been having a relationship, and then after this was in print that you were going to get married,
he kind of cut off
the relationship. So I'm wondering, when someone is as like extraordinary a singer as Frank Sinatra, but you're really angry with that person because of the way they behaved towards you, how does the singing sound? Could you still appreciate his singing, or were you so just really angry at the way he behaved that you couldn't even listen to his records anymore and thought he was, in fact, a lousy singer?
No, I couldn't think he was a lousy singer because he was never a lousy singer. But I was in such a bad, terrible emotional state that I actually didn't want to listen to him very much for that reason. But as for the quality of his work, no. I mean, nobody sounded better than Frank did at that time. Nobody did.
A lot of actresses complain that when you stop being a young actress, that the roles dry up. That, you know, for men, there's roles when you get older, you know, like Clint Eastwood could play the leading man.
And how?
And there's no such equivalent for women. And is that something you've felt through your career?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's not only age, because a lot of younger actresses cannot find work. They cannot find parts to play. First of all, they're not being written now. Second of all, you have men like Clint Eastwood, who I am crazy about, I must say. He plays in pictures with 20-year-old girls. But a woman can't do that. A woman can't play in a movie with younger guys and have relationships of any kind. Forget it.
When you were young, your hero on screen was Bette Davis.
Yes.
And you even got to meet her and say hello when you were very young.
No, but you see, she had adult roles
to
play until she had to put an ad in the Hollywood Reporter saying that she was out of work and she was ready and able to go to work.
And then, I mean...
Shocking that Bette Davis, the greatest star, I think, ever in motion pictures.
Okay, and then some of the roles that she got were these kind of perverse, demonic older women
Baby
roles,
Jane.
Like Baby Jane. You know, she was just like a horror. And you know,
wonderful actress.
So I'm wondering, like, here she was, your model when she was younger. What did you think of her as a model for, you know, as an older actress?
Well, I must say that I always loved her, and I think that she, for me, was the best actress and the most exciting female star on the screen. I think her work will live forever. I think it's timeless. And as she got older, her talent did not diminish. I mean, whatever happened to Baby Jane, whatever, it was a wonderful job of acting that she did. She looked like a fright, but that was the part. But she could convey almost anything. She was quite extraordinary talent. And unfortunately, she didn't have an opportunity to do as much as she wanted to. But she was a woman who had to work. And I understand that better than most people do, that you have to work.
Well, your mother was a woman who had to work, too.
Absolutely.
So you grew up with that as a model.
I grew up with that. Was the work ethic was very high on our list in our household. I mean, my uncle was a lawyer and my other uncle was a lawyer. Everyone in my family worked. And that's the way we were brought up and I was brought up. And I'm glad I was.
Before I let you go, clear up something for me.
Yeah.
In To Have and Have Not, I'd always heard, Lauren Bacall's voice is dubbed by Andy Williams.
God, yes.
And then now in Leonard Maltin's movie guidebook, he says that Andy Williams dubbed the songs, but they never used the tape. What is the story?
Yes, well, he's correct, because the story is they did not dub the songs. Howard Hawks feared that I would not hit the notes, the high notes,
mm-hmm.
of How Little We Know.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Andy Williams come in and record it
mm-hmm.
in case I didn't sound, because I was taking singing lessons at Warner Brothers. And they finally, if you listen to the song, you will know that there's no doubt that it's me, because Andy Williams with that beautiful voice, one would have seen the difference immediately. So they did not, he ended up not using it. And that's the true story. So it's only me with my flat baritone.
Would you have been annoyed if the voice were dubbed? Did you try to say to Hawks, don't do it?
Well, I couldn't say, I would never say don't do it to Howard Hawks. You're kidding, I was too frightened of him. But I would certainly have preferred to have done it myself, yes. I'm against all the fake stuff. I'm not into that. I would rather stumble through a song and then mouth the words to somebody else's voice.
Lauren Bacall spoke with Terry Gross in 1994. She died Tuesday in New York. She was 89.
Go ahead, go to work. You all set, Slim?
Sure, but don't make it sad, Cricket. I don't feel that way.
You don't look that way either. Let's go. Top note, boys.